Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Nancy J. Troy. She's the Victoria and Roger Sant Professor in Art Emerita at Stanford University, and Anne Marguerite Tartsinis, Scholar of 20th Century American Art, Fashion, and Craft. And we're talking about their new book, Mondrian's Dress, Yves Saint Laurent, Piet Mondrian, and Pop Art. Nancy and Anne, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
We're thrilled to be here.
I'm glad.
Thanks so much for having us.
Now, what brought you to write this book? Because it's such a unique book.
This book started out as part of a study of what happened to Mondrian after he died. The circulation of his work and so forth. And of course, Yves Saint Laurent is a major figure in that kind of reception and history of Mondrian. And probably many listeners will know that Mondrian was vastly commodified and still is today. You can go to almost any museum shop and buy all sorts of Mondrian paraphernalia. So we wanted to look into how that happened, and we understood that this dress or these dresses by Yves Saint Laurent were critical to the reception of Mondrian
until today. For me, the fascinating thing is the dresses still look sharp. They're still fascinating and beautiful looking.
It's really quite remarkable. I mean, I think part of it is that the image of the dress, the way in which Yves Saint Laurent appropriated Mondrian has become so iconic over time, which is certainly something we talk about in the book and has been, you know, become a brand icon, not just for Yves Saint Laurent, but in some ways, of course, as Nancy was just alluding to, for Mondrian.
Now let's talk about Mondrian for a second, because many of people in the audience may not know who he was. He was a great modernist painter from the Netherlands. Can you talk? He died in New York in 1944. So he was dead and not painting for decades before the Yves Saint Laurent dresses came out. Talk to me about neoplasticism in his art. As soon as you start describing the art, I'm sure people will remember what it looks like.
Mondrian's kind of iconic classic paintings were made in the 1920s and 1930s. He actually changed it somewhat, made it more kind of dynamic when he came to New York. But throughout that whole period, he was using only primary colors, which are red, yellow, and blue, plus white, gray, and usually a black grid. But he was painting with very flattened forms, rectangles, often of different sizes that seem to kind of have a dynamic balance in a composition. He was not using symmetrical forms, so there's always a kind of dynamic feel to even, you know, the most potentially staid-looking objects. One other thing to note about Mondrian is that his work looks extremely simple.
Yeah.
But he never measured. He always arrived at his compositions by a kind of practice of trying it out and changing and so on. So the other thing to note is that in reproduction, they look even flatter than they actually are. So there's a kind of parallel that we discerned between Yves Saint Laurent's extremely, what would it be, sophisticated methods of, you know, in his couture house by the seamstresses and so on who put the dresses together, and Mondrian's own very, very carefully brushed surfaces. So when you actually see a Mondrian in person, the object is much less of a design than it appeared to be to Yves Saint Laurent, who discovered these works in reproduction.
Well, let's talk about the collection. It was 1965, the Autumn Winter Couture Collection, ready to wear. How many classic Yves Saint Laurent Mondrian dresses are there?
Well, that's the question we set out to answer. And in fact, the answer is one that is not very straightforward, which is why the book is, you know, so kind of lengthy in its answer about that. And so what we've discerned is there's, of course, what we call the iconic model number 81 Mondrian dress,
yep,
which is the one that looks most like one of Mondrian's paintings with the red, yellow, and blue squares. But of course, there's also numerous others, and there are two kind of lesser known, but certainly one, the number 77, which just had one red quadrant at the shoulder, which was very popular at the time in 1965, and in numerous well-known fashion photographs by Richard Avedon and Irving Penn, for example, as well as many others, in fact, some that kind of are so distinctly different from anything Mondrian would have ever painted, like the model number 101, which is in the collection. There's a copy in the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is hot pink.
Ooh,
it's kind
ooh,
of almost like ooh, full shift with some black piping that is, you know, entirely pink. So as your listeners probably know, and certainly as you know, that looks nothing like a Mondrian.
No, hot pink, no. Now, what happened in the mid-1960s where suddenly Mondrian's artwork starts showing up in a lot of other pop artist work? Like, let's talk about Roy Lichtenstein and Tom Wesselman. I mean, they have artworks where a Mondrian appears in it. He shows up in a Schlitz ad, as you mentioned in your book, in 1953. So that's earlier. But George Siegel's Portrait of Sidney Janus, his sculpture is actually looking at a Mondrian painting. What happened in the decades that went between his death, Mondrian's death, and suddenly Mondrian's paintings become an icon, like a brand icon?
One thing that's really fascinating is that Mondrian had what one could call followers in New York when he was there. Those are artists who believed in the same kind of formal characteristics, utopian ideals that they represented for Mondrian, who wrote many essays, and quite a few of them were translated and published around the time just after his death. So there were artists in New York who knew Mondrian and who wanted to paint like Mondrian and who did paint like Mondrian. So one of the things that's kind of very different is that when it comes to the 1960s, and we can see in the work of, for example, of Lichtenstein or of Wesselman, that there are obvious references to Mondrian's work. They are much more in the kind of genre of mechanical reproduction, mm-hmm, using, in the case of Lichtenstein, his kind of Bende dots that he took over from popular comic strips. And in the case of Wesselman, who just used a reproduction and pasted it onto a painting in one case. So the idea for them was, in some ways, I mean, I think it's intriguing to think about what does it mean that actually Yves Saint Laurent, who was a very young man in 1965, not yet 30 years old, he had actually not seen an original painting by Mondrian, which as art historians, I think Anne and I found shocking.
Yeah.
How could that be? But he too discovered these in reproductive form and in a certain way that perhaps liberated him to think about his own contribution, how he might respond as a designer to the kind of design qualities. And we find that, you know, in a certain way, so he was actually interested in the work of Warhol, who was a friend, and of Lichtenstein and Wesselman. So even before he presented work in the genre of pop art, which he did a year later, you know, he was thinking about these figures. And so we see the him in a way. There are ways to think about the kind of the beauty and the delicacy and the, you know, the expertise would be the best word, of the sewing of his dresses and their presentation that correspond to paintings by Mondrian. But in their design kind of aspect, and the fact that they are couture works, but he thought of them as potentially related to a much more popular art form that reaches a younger audience. So in that sense, those dresses relate also to these pop artists. That's the argument we try to make.
It needs to be reemphasized that Yves Saint Laurent and his significant other, Pierre Berger, were well-known collectors of art. And you have several beautiful photographs included in this book of the interior of his house, where there's all sorts of incredible works of art that he has acquired. But as you're saying, he never acquired a Mondrian?
No, well, he did, but it was after the creation of the Mondrian dresses.
So he sort of felt compelled. He had to get a Mondrian after all.
Exactly. So they ended up owning 3 Mondrian paintings over the years. But again, when in 1965, when Yves Saint Laurent designed these dresses, it was, as Nancy said, from a book that was given to him. You know, as the story goes, it was given to him as a present from his mother.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Nancy J. Troy. She is the Victoria and Roger Sant Professor in Art Emerita at Stanford University, and Anne Marguerite Tartsinis, Scholar of 20th Century American Art, Fashion, and Craft. And we're talking about their new book. I really have to emphasize what a beautiful book this is, as well as the writing is. They just cover every single base in this book. Mondrian's Dress, Yves Saint Laurent, Piet Mondrian, and Pop Art. I also found it fascinating, George Siegel's sculpture that he has of Sidney Janus, and looking at a Mondrian. Sidney Janus was the first American to visit Mondrian in his Paris studio in 1932. So it's actually a bit of art history in that particular artwork.
So Sidney Janus was actually, he wasn't the first, but he was a very important figure in the work of Mondrian. He happens to have played also a very significant role in the early history of pop art, having organized an exhibition of pop artists very early on. Mondrian was already dead, but one can see him operating in those two spheres. But he did visit Mondrian very early, and he was at the time a collector and not yet a dealer, which he became at the end of the 1940s. And he really was responsible for kind of creating the market for Mondrian's work, especially in the United States. He went annually to Europe during a period when many people who had collected or who had been friends with Mondrian, not everybody, but there were some who owned paintings by Mondrian and who ultimately sold them to Sidney Janus, who also bought a very important tranche of the paintings directly from Mondrian's American heir, an artist named Harry Holtzman. So that is really true. He also, in a way, became good friends of Mondrian, he and his wife, during the period Mondrian was in New York. And Mondrian was a favorite of his. So he commissioned that portrait of himself looking at his, well, it was the idea of the artist, but he's looking at his favorite Mondrian poised, as you see there, on his dealer's easel, as if, you know, he's admiring it, but it's for sale.
Let's talk about fashion in the mid-60s, like 1965, 1967, 1968. This was the time of swinging London. There were other appropriations of pop art into fashion, and some of it not by known fashion designers either. I love the little sort of rabbit holes that you guys go down in this book, because you follow every single possible connection. Let's talk about the Campbell soup dress. There was a Campbell soup dress that was produced by Campbell soup.
It's quite remarkable. The Campbell soup dress is a paper dress, and, you know, just to kind of describe it for your listeners, it features a grid of imagery of Campbell soup, the cover, the fronts of Campbell soup cans kind of in a grid across the front of the simple shift dress that it is. And so admirers of Campbell's, you know, famous soups in the 1960s could send in a certain number of labels and $1 and then receive this paper dress in the mail. And it was quite a remarkable promotional stunt.
Obviously citing Andy Warhol. Now, are there examples of that dress still extant?
Yes. Yes, there are a handful. I know that one was recently on view at the Museum of Arts and Design in New York City for a paper dress exhibition that they had. And the one that we reproduced in the book is from the Kant Art Collection at Stanford. And, you know, it's what's so interesting about it is that it's often believed to have been by Andy Warhol, who also dabbled in fashion and certainly, you know, had made other types of garments with his screen printed designs at other points in his career.
There's even...
And so he often blurred the boundaries between, of course, the commercial and the kind of and what, you know, might be called fine art at the time.
There's even a green stamp dress, and there's a great photo of Eleanor Biddle Lloyd wearing a green stamp dress at a Warhol exhibition. So there was this whole sort of confusion and exchange of pop and commercial appropriation of these images that went on at that time.
Absolutely. These are, I mean, one thing to note that Anne actually uncovered is that, well, in any event, I think it's in the book too, that there was a guy at Campbell Soup who regretted that he never bought a painting by Warhol because he realized in the early 1960s that they had increased in value already so much that he could not afford it. But instead, they were sending kind of boxes of Campbell Soup and other grocery commodities to Warhol to supply him, because of course he was a great ad for it was great publicity for Campbell's soup, that's for sure.
I like the fact that you even try to answer the question, was Mondrian fashion conscious? And I'll tell you, he looks pretty sharp in the photographs that you include in the book, but would you say Mondrian was a sort of a fashion icon at the time?
Well, let me answer that. Yes, Mondrian was himself interested in men's clothes, and there are a few stories about that, not many. And he wrote a little bit about fashion insofar as for Mondrian, the divisions between art and life would eventually, in a way, kind of atrophy and fade away when life itself and people were sophisticated enough to understand his kind of painting and move forward into the world he imagined of modernity. And for him, music, design, architecture, and also fashion or clothing should all be part of the expression of a kind of modernist approach to living. So yes, he was interested, at least as far as that goes. Plus, he supposedly loved looking at men's suits in department store windows in Paris.
Now, Yves Saint Laurent really controlled reporters' access to the upcoming collection before he released it, because he knew what was going to happen, that everybody was going to copy it. And you have all the articles from places like Women's Wear Daily. There's an article called Mondrian Madness that comes out. And there's all sorts of knockoffs of Mondrian's dresses. But what made them such a success? They were incredible. They were literally a sensation when they came out. And like I said, even looking at them today, they're really visually stunning.
Yes, it is quite remarkable that we illustrate this really wonderful kind of front page spread from the Miami Herald, which shows the kind of steps that the dress went through in such a short period of time, really a matter of weeks, where it went from the couture original by Yves Saint Laurent to a kind of department store copy to all the way down to a down market, you know, very cheap, only a few dollars kind of cheap printed dress in the same style of the Mondrian painting, of the original Mondrian dress. And even, of course, how one might do their eye makeup to match. Because there were some great kind of paint, just for your listeners, some great kind of painted kind of geometric imagery on a model's eyelids in this front page depiction. So it's really quite remarkable. It, as you said, it really was a sensation. And Yves Saint Laurent, as much as he and Pierre Berger tried to limit copying, they also, you know, they did that within their couture show, but then they licensed copies to high-end department stores or department stores with high-end ateliers that kind of made to measure dresses for their clients. So that already started to kind of promote this idea of a kind of next generation of dresses. And Yves Saint Laurent in October 1965 even traveled around the United States visiting these department stores to look at the copies that they were making, which were very much sanctioned copies and are certainly distinct and very different from the unsanctioned copies that were done, you know, by these kind of cheap kind of fast fashion, what we might call fast fashion now, right? Fast fashion producers of the Mondrian dresses at the time.
It's very fascinating when you write about Saint Laurent's sort of relationship with Mondrian's paintings. Because he described it not as that he was copying the artworks, that he was having a dialogue, and he did not cite, he interpreted. Can you elaborate on that?
I think that's one of the most fascinating and elusive kinds of aspects of thinking about these dresses. So on the one hand, there's Yves Saint Laurent being, one would imagine, inspired by the images that he saw in this book and feeling that he could make something of them. And Mondrian, as well as one other artist in 1965, were the first that he actually kind of went out and tried to make dresses that are reminiscent of works of art. And it became, famously, something that he pursued throughout the rest of his 40-year career. So that's to begin with. But the question that intrigued Anne and me was, well, what do we do about the fact that in the printed program that accompanied this, the presentation, the first presentation of these dresses in August 1965, there is no mention of Mondrian or of art. And so, in a way, that became the response of the press. And all the, you know, just to mention again, these very famous photographers, Penn, Avedon, David Bailey, made stunning photographs for very prominent magazines. And there were a lot of other, you know, ads and so on, and knockoff kind of images in circulating in ads of Mondrian, you know, related materials, slippers, bathing suits, bras, what have you. But so this question that you're asking, I think, is among the most intriguing. What is the relationship between, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said, well, he wasn't copying. It's something else. And so Anne and I are a bit skeptical in the book about the many, many, many exhibitions that have placed his dresses in front of, on the wall, paintings by Mondrian. And the idea, presumably, is to say, oh, I get it. They look very similar, which, of course, they do. But we were interested to articulate beyond that kind of initial visual similarity, more nuance in the relationship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we even question the term dialogue because, of course, Mondrian was dead. There wasn't
That's right.
dialogue,
right.
really. There was a whatever it was that you would call what Yves Saint Laurent was doing. And he was extremely good at it. But nevertheless, it's an interesting question because Mondrian was looked at by every generation of other painters. Barnett Newman with his series, Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, and Blue. Jasper Johns, for whom Mondrian was an important artist, not to mention Lichtenstein, who appropriated many things, or at many points in his career, works by Mondrian. So, anyway, that's a really intriguing question, I would say, that, you know, there could be numerous perspectives on, points of entry, and we hope our readers will feel provoked to think about those questions.
We're completely out of time, but it's really interesting to consider that Yves Saint Laurent was a willing participant in the popularization process of this. And we can't have this discussion, but there's a whole thing about Rive Gauche and the perfume and the whole thing about the popularization of this these imagery. But we're going to have to leave that for another time. My guest tonight have been Nancy J. Troy, the Victoria and Roger Sant Professor in Art Emerita at Stanford University, and Anne Marguerite Tartsinas, Scholar of the 20th Century American Art, Fashion, and Craft. And we've been talking about a book. It is just a gorgeous book. It's a large format book, and the essays are just fantastic. Mondrian's Dress, Yves Saint Laurent, Piet Mondrian, and Pop Art. Nancy and Anne, thank you so much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.